In September 2000, hundreds of heads of state met at the United Nations to ratify the UN Millennium Declaration. By doing so, they affirmed their faith in the United Nations and its charter as indispensable foundations for a more peaceful, prosperous, and just world. Millennium Development Goals included significantly reducing poverty, hunger, malaria, AIDS, and increasing child schooling by 2015, amongst other progressive initiatives. Last month, the UN hosted a Millennium Plus 5 summit to evaluate the progress towards the goals. According to the Global Policy Forum, the resulting document was embarrassingly weak and filled mostly with empty platitudes. James Paul is the executive director of the New York-based Global Policy Forum, a think tank that monitors policymaking at the United Nations. He's joined me on the phone from his home in New York. Good afternoon, James.
Yeah, good afternoon. Nice to be with you.
Great. Glad to have you. The United Nations is criticized by everyone. What's at the root of its inefficiency and vulnerability to criticism?
Well, the basic problem here is that there is one state in particular, the United States of America, that really prefers to run the world by its own rules. There are, of course, other powerful states that would just as soon not cooperate with others also. And so we have a situation where too many in the global system want to work outside of, around, and against the UN. And so although the vast majority of the world's peoples and a very strong majority of world's governments want to see the UN a strong place and a place of multilateral decision-making, the actors that really count aren't ready to support that idea.
Many of these states want to reform the UN. Can you generalize as to who wants what sort of reforms?
Well, again, the most powerful would rather see a weak UN, and I think we've seen that very, very clearly from Washington over the last 20 years in particular. Of course, Washington was responsible for the founding of the UN after World War II, but as many, many former colonial countries gained independence and the UN seemed to be getting to be a place that was slipping out from Washington's control, they really wanted to keep it a relatively weak organization or to weaken it. And so, for instance, at Washington's insistence, the budget of the United Nations has been capped for the last 20 years. And that means that all the very important projects that need to be done just can't be afforded by the UN. It can't even, its meetings can't even go on past a certain hour because there's not any money to run them. It's a sad and pathetic situation, and it's hard to see how we can get around it right now.
What do other nations want?
Well, I think Canada has been much more supportive of the project of multilateralism and a stronger UN. This includes things like disarmament and sort of development goals that might just go beyond platitudes. But even Canada, frankly, doesn't provide enough overseas development assistance and prefers in many ways to defend its interests as a rich country against the poor countries of the world in terms of the trading system, agricultural subsidies, a lot of things like that. So basically, it's not just Washington against the rest, it's also the rich against the poor. There's a number of lines of division out there, and all those divisions keep the United States weaker, the United Nations much weaker than it should be.
Is there a special case for Security Council reform different than the general case we've been talking about?
Well, the general case is to that was proposed by several sort of secondary powers, Brazil, India, Germany and Japan, and maybe South Africa and Nigeria, wanted to become permanent members of the Security Council along with the existing five permanent members. I think that was a very bad idea. That would see something like 10 or 11 permanent members in the council, each with their own special interests, each there forever, so to speak. The best way to reform the Security Council is on a regional basis, and that I think may happen in the future as we see regional organizations getting more important. For instance, Europe should be represented by a European seat and not by the United Kingdom, France, and possibly Germany.
What about reformation of the veto?
Well, the veto has to go. Permanency of membership has to go. These are signs of this oligarchy that runs the Security Council right now, and it doesn't have anything in common with a democratic future for the world. It's not easy to eliminate those things because, of course, the institution has been set up in such a way that institutional change can't happen without their agreement. But after all, kings used to have absolute power, and they don't anymore. So the world changes, and it's likely to here as well.
What were the goals of Millennium Plus 5 reforms?
Well, the Millennium Plus 5 summit had quite a wide range of goals. It weren't just about reforming the UN. Many people think that that was the main thing. The main thing actually was a series of policy issues that were being addressed. And you mentioned the Millennium Development Goals that addressed various issues having to do with poverty and education and so on. There were also other issues about the environment and disarmament and so on. It was quite an ambitious document in a lot of ways, but at the end of the day, Washington insisted on many hundreds of changes, pretty much taking out everything that was important in the text, and that those demands were put on the table about 2.5 weeks before the summit, so the summit really came completely unraveled at that point.
And so the U.S. initiated this process before the summit to make these changes?
Yes, there had been quite a long process of discussion of the issues coming together for the summit. The Secretary General had put together a high-level panel. There was another group that was studying the economic issues. The high-level panel dealt with the security side. And after those reports were issued, then there was a intergovernmental negotiating process that got underway. I guess it was in March. And from March up until the end of July, it was clear that there was difficulties in negotiation, but it seemed to be going forward. And then in the middle of August when a lot of delegations, some of their people had gone off on vacation and so on. There was only 2.5 weeks to go. That's when Ambassador Bolton put down his demands. There's different counts. Some people say there were 400 changes. Some say there were 700 changes. I haven't been able to go through and count them all. It was a very, very large number of demands, that threw the whole negotiation into a tailspin. And I think the final document... Other countries, of course, at that point, realizing that the consensus had been breached, made demands of their own, and that speeded the process towards, a lack of anything serious.
Can you give us some background information on John Bolton?
John Bolton, actually, I'm afraid I can't give you the real full rundown on him. The United States has named some pretty tough cookies as ambassadors in recent years. One thinks of John Negroponte, for example. But Bolton had a background in fairly far-right politics. He held a number of offices in government, in the Department of State. He was during his, and he also worked for the one of the right-wing think tanks. I can't remember whether it was the American Enterprise Institute or the Heritage Foundation, but in any event, he was a creature of the far right. And when he was named by the president, when he was nominated, and it was came before the Senate for their approval, quite a number of things came out about Mr. Bolton, including his fiery temper and his tendency towards exaggeration, his ideological character, and things like that. A lot of people around the UN, not knowing some of his background, were rather surprised to hear the history of this guy and what he'd been like. I guess he made some very, very provocative statements in Korea, having to do with North Korea. So he's known to be always heading towards conflict and the opposite of what an ambassador would normally be.
How do you respond to those on the left seeking a more just and equal world who say that the United Nations is beyond reform?
Well, it's only one short step beyond that to say the world is beyond reform. It's easy to take either position. There's a lot of discouraging things going on out there. My sense is that the UN, which is full of discouraging news these days for sure, is nonetheless a place where there's some possibility for NGOs and like-minded governments to come together and look at things in a slightly different way. I think the UN will have to be changed in very, very dramatic ways in order that the world go in the direction we hope for. But we have to realize that to do away with the UN is a little bit like doing away with the national parliament on the grounds that the national parliament isn't really doing its job. I mean, people normally accept really extreme folks way out there politically wouldn't say, well, the Canadian parliament is useless, let's do away with it, because the fact is it's a certain bastion against complete despotism. That's the other option. So I say let's not do away with the UN at this point. It's the best thing we have. Let's work as much as we can to make this a better institution and to make this world a better place. And we'll certainly see somewhere along the line some institutions develop that will take us past where the UN is now, and that'll be welcome.
What do we need for the sort of reform that many of the world's poorer countries are looking for?
Well, I think most fundamentally, the world's poorest countries need some basic changes in the world's economic order. That's a matter that has been largely forced out of the UN by the richest countries into other venues like the G8 summits and so on. The international trading system is extremely unfair to the poorest countries. The international financial system is set up in such a way that it pumps resources out of poor countries and into rich ones. The dictators in poor countries are very often able and even encouraged to send their money into the banks in London and New York, where it sits and does the banks, allows them to make big profits. It's a world that, in so many ways, looks like it's run by mafiosi, you might say, and it's that kind of a world that is very, very difficult to change because there's leaders in the southern countries are often complicit in that system. So it's, you know, we've got a long way to go.
Well, thank you for speaking with me this morning, or this afternoon for you.
Yeah.
have a great day.
Yeah, thank you so much. Nice to be with you.
I've been talking with James Paul. James Paul is the executive director of the New York-based Global Policy Forum. You can find huge amounts of analysis and information on UN reform on their website at globalpolicy.org.